I'm K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. And along with K2, Kilowatt, Echo, Yankee, his name is Mel, my name is Dick. Mel and Dick, try to orchestrate a thing called the technical net. And as you guys have heard us say so often before, the main subject of the technical net is the subjects that you guys bring. It's a gathering of the ham radio clan in which we try to help each other with this fairly complicated hobby of ham radio. Try to get each of us to understand how these antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation, how does all that stuff work? How does a signal get from here to there? Remote action at a distance. That's what radio really is, wireless. And if you really want to understand wireless, you become a ham radio operator. It's the fastest way to get the most amount of knowledge in that subject in the least amount of time. The schools do a mediocre job of teaching that subject, in the opinion of some informed people. And you really want a person who understands antennas, you hire a ham radio operator. A person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or a comment by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name. Try to remember to give me your name, because I'm so darn forgetful. And then the word yes or no, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins tonight? Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
KD2, Jackson.
W2JPW, Lou.
So far we got Mr. JXM, who doesn't have a name, and Lou, JPW. Mr. JXM, what is your name, sir?
You get me outside?
Mr. JXM, we're getting you very noisy, but please tell me your name.
Gary over here.
Okay, Gary over here. Very good. We got Gary and Lou. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
N2MB Mobile. I'm going to be in and out, so if you turn it over to me and I don't respond, that's because I'm out for a few minutes. N2MB Barry.
Very fine, Barry. Haven't heard from you in a long time. In fact, since you're only there briefly, let's give you the chance to go first. What's the latest in your neighborhood? Is that 28-foot dish on top of a windjammer tower? I know the answer to that. That's a little bit too big of an undertaking. So what portion of the many kinds of ham radio you've been delving in keeps you occupied these days, Barry? N2, Moon Bounce, K2RIW.
Okay, well, let me see. First of all, I've been eyeballing an 18-foot dish along Rockaway Beach Boardwalk, where I run my 4 or 5 miles every day. It seems to be abandoned. I'm going to have to find out what the status of it is. It actually... Good night, sweetheart. I'm getting kissed by a beautiful little girl. Say hello to Dick.
Hi, Dick.
Okay. And let me see what else. Once I got one more head to kiss here, then I'll get back in. Okay, so now... where was I? So there's actually about 6 of them out there, so I plan... I'm vigorously planning on taking home at least 2 of them in the next few weeks. I did make some progress on my vertical beam for 75 meters. I am working again on the driven element, the first element of it. I changed it over from open wire line to coax this week, and I'm trying to get it tuned up. I want it to be a good match. Then I'm going to build the other one, which I've already got constructed. It's just sitting in the yard. I want to do one element at a time. And, I drop the first element, bring the second element up, tune it up, bring the 2 of them up. Then I'm going to put the phasing line between them, and then I'm going to have the 2-element beam on 75. And that's the progress I've been making this week. N2MB, back to Dick, net control.
Hello, beautiful little girl. That kiss is Barry. And sounds like fun, Barry. 6 dishes of 18 feet each. Are those built in the style of a television receive-only terminal ground station? I'm guessing not. I'm guessing they're a little bit more rugged to be along the boardwalk at Rockaway Boardwalk, I guess, where they've got to tolerate the winds coming off the water. These must be pretty rugged dishes with pretty fancy mounting structure. In a couple of minutes, I'm going to pass it back to you and ask you how rugged do they look? How long do you think they've been abandoned? And sounds like you've got your eye on them. When it comes to vertical antennas, vertically polarized antennas, of the type that are similar to half-wave dipole or multiple elements of the same. Mel has been telling us for some time that that vertical half-wave dipole that he's got strung in his evergreen tree out in front of his house gives a ridiculously high performance. And although the introductory books teaching us ham radio always show a simple dipole as something horizontal and parallel to the ground, it's time we start investigating vertical ones, which give you a lot more for the money. So that vertical antenna of yours sounds like a fun thing. I've got a tower of the same altitude approximately as yours, and therefore if I took that halyard with a pulley up at the top of the tower and ran up a half-wave dipole and ran it with a proper impedance match, feeding it at the bottom, half-wave dipole fed at the bottom at the outer end, is a 1,500 ohm impedance approximately. But once you get over that minor detail, I think that antenna can have an awful lot of performance. So one of these days, I want to do what you're doing. So tell me a little bit about those 18-foot dishes, and put my name on the list. I'll help you move one. Back to you, Barry. N2 Moonbound, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah. Now, the 18-foot dishes are solid Andrews dishes. They're beautiful dishes. Several of them have some damage on them because when they took them off of those pedestals, they were not being very kind to them. I think they just threw them on the ground. So I think four out of them have fairly good damage. I mean, it's not that you can't fix it, but there's one that has no damage, and that's, of course, the one I'm going to get first. There's another one that has mild damage, and that will be my backup. And the rest of them, I think we should, once I procure them and make sure that I can have them, I would like to sort of spread the word around. So anybody who wants an 18-foot dish should run over there quick and get it. N2MB.
Yeah, the price is right. Sounds awfully good. I'm a little disappointed that it's solid. That means it's going to have an awful lot of wind load. That's the bad news. The good news, though, a solid dish with enough surface accuracy can give you good reflection to, let's say, 47 or 85 gigahertz, you know, really high frequencies if you wanted to, and there's ways of, detuning, detuning them if you wanted to, with a little bit of extra effort. Sounds like fun. What's your rough guess as to the weight? Is this a spun aluminum dish with a little bit of a frame behind it, or is it the full-blown Andrews thing with a great big truss work behind it, making sure that it's super strong and ready to survive a Texas tower application? Back to you, Barry.
Okay, it appears to be, because I've been looking at them quite a bit, there's some kind of impregnated fiberglass. That's what they are. I don't know what they got in the fiberglass, but that's what they are. And they look like they're beautifully shaped. I mean, you know, the fiberglass is really a good parabolic. So I think those things would be good for just about any frequency any self-respecting ham would want to put them on.
Okay, you've given me one more piece of information that's a little bit disappointing. The solid dish means a hell of a lot of wind load. And although a number of respected good Andrew dish designs were made out of fiberglass, when it comes to holding their shape, moderately good, but the fiberglass ones tend to be about twice as heavy as a more aluminum one. So 18-foot diameter fiberglass, probably with a little bit of frame behind it as a mounting structure. I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find that each one of those is a healthy 500 pounds. What do you think, Barry?
Well, I can't lift them. So I haven't been able to weigh them, of course, but I cannot lift them. I tried. I cannot get it off the ground. So I would assume my guess was they were about 300 to 400 pounds, somewhere in the 300 to 400 pound range. And it's a tough one, but it's a good antenna, and it's worth the trouble.
When you say you can't lift it, does that mean it's on the ground face down, and to lift it means you have to lift, you know, one half of the whole darn antenna? Most likely it's not on the ground aimed face up in the birdbath mode, otherwise it would be collecting a whole lot of water. But even if it's aimed up and you can't lift it, I understand, but can you rock it? Are you able to move any one of them in any way at all by which you can get a little bit of a feel for how much mass you're moving? Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, I can rock them. That I can do, but I can't actually lift them off the ground. You see, I got to have a little more strength. I think, well, my feelings are that three people, and that's my plan, by the way, three people getting in, you know, picking a spot around that dish. They're all facing up, by the way. No, actually, that's not true. One of them is facing down, a couple of them are facing up, and I really did make a note of that. But my plan was to go there with three folks, lift them up, and walk them out of there. So I kind of believe three people could get them up and out of there. So my best guess is around 300 pounds.
Yeah, but the guy Barry I know is so darn strong that for a two-second period of time, he might be able to lift 300 pounds. And the fact that you can't do that suggests that it's more than 300. Are any of the feed horn assemblies there, Barry? Go ahead.
Well, the feeds are all gone. The pedestals are all destroyed. That much I can tell you. But most of the antennas have their structure in the back is intact. And as I say, the shape of the pedals are pretty darn good. Looks great, actually. One of them I noticed has a damaged pedal. Probably repairable. You know, it's got like a crack on it where they threw it off the stand, you know, just right onto the ground. It's kind of heavy, so I guess it sustained a little bit of damage when they just chucked it off the stand, you know, because it was above ground by, I guess, around 10 feet up or 12 feet up, something like that. You know, about 14 feet up, and they just disconnected it from the stand and let it flop over, so that kind of damaged a few of them like that.
When you say pedals, does that mean it's not one solid molded piece of fiberglass? There are individual pedals of fiberglass that are screwed together, bolted together. That's what impression I'm getting right now. And that could be helpful when it comes to taking them apart for transport. Of course, to transport something on the Belt Parkway, let's say, that's 18 feet in diameter, that's out of the question. Illegal. But if you can make it much smaller because the pedals come apart, that would help. And the pedestals being completely destroyed, was the pedestal made out of pieces of steel tubing that somebody bent up and made into a pile? How do you completely destroy a pedestal, and why would you do that? Back to you, Barry.
Okay, well, it appears that the pedestals, some of them are just gone, some of them are just cut. In other words, they just took some kind of a saw. I don't know what those pedestals are made out of because they're in such bad shape, I really paid little to no attention to them. They look like they're a total loss. And the dishes, now that you mention it, are four pieces. They're four pedals, you know, and they have like a rim, and they're bolted together at those ribs. You know, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, when it comes to fiberglass dishes, you can take a dish that's, let's say, aimed at the horizon, and you can cut a couple of horizontal slashes through it in order to break it into pieces. Or you can break it up into orange peels, if you know what I mean, triangular-shaped objects. Are these triangular-shaped objects with a circular center? Go ahead. N2MB, K2RIW, still there, Barry?
Yeah, I got a bad fuse. I can feel it's hot and all get out. Just reached the back of the seat, and I can feel this fuse is really warm. That's what just happened to me. One second.
Yeah, you could go to lower power, your DFQ into the machine.
Okay, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to join you upstairs. I'm just going to get out of the car and get back into the net in a few seconds. N2MB.
Okay, take your time. We'll come back to you and take somebody else in the meantime. So take your time getting upstairs. Go to Gary next, KB2JXM. Hope your signal is holding up, Gary. And go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RIW in the group.
I don't know if I'm holding up here from Wayne, New Jersey here, but Maven, I was going to ask you about calibrating a network analyzer for S1 and S2.
Okay. I got enough of that message. You're in there 80% of the time, Gary. When it comes to a network analyzer, calibrating it for S1 and S2, S11 and S22. The right way to do it is with a Mori microwave calibration kit. That's the good news. And the bad news is that calibration kit is $5,000 or $8,000, some ridiculous number. The calibration kit consists of a perfect short circuit, a perfect open circuit and a perfect 50-ohm load that's got something like a 50 or 60 decibel reflection coefficient and is good, DC to light in frequency. Very precisely made things. Now, as long as you can get your hands on something that you know by some means is a good load, the short and the open, that's fairly easy to construct. But the, although a slight difficulty of that is that the number of millimeters of distance from the front surface of the connector to the point inside of the calibration device that presents a short or an open, in theory that should be a given number of millimeters that's identical for both the short and the open. Other than that, the calibration procedure built into the modern day network analyzers could get a little bit confused. But the hard part is the 50 ohm load. To have a known good 50 ohm load to use as a reference for calibration is a little bit difficult. Every one of the dummy loads that you and I can buy are going to have something like a 1.2 standing wave ratio. You'd like to be 1.001 in order to calibrate your network analyzer because it is looking for that exact characteristic device at the end of the cable in order to know how to set its internal 18 figures. The so-called 18-point correction procedure, or is it 12-point? I think it's 18-point. Anyhow, the modern-day network analyzers have a fairly complicated program inside that corrects for what is happening at the end of your test cable. Rarely do you use a network analyzer and calibrate it right to the front panel. You calibrate it with that particular piece of testing cable you got from the front
repeater. Time out.
You calibrate it with that testing piece of cable that goes from the front panel to your device under test, your point of measurement. And when the network analyzer is working correctly, that piece of cable could be reasonably poor in its characteristics, as long as those characteristics are constant, as long as it doesn't change its characteristics when you bend it and pull on it and whatever. So the network analyzer is capable of taking out all of the characteristics of your piece of testing cable, and it makes its point of reference right at the end of that cable, where you plug in the short, the open, and the perfect 50-ohm dummy load, or termination as it's called. So without a known good termination, to get a good calibration on the network analyzer is a bit difficult. However, that's not a showstopper. If, for instance, your particular dummy load has a standing wave ratio of 1.2, all that really means is that as you are testing objects that approach goodness of 1.2 standing wave ratio, you're now entering the area of ambiguity where you're not quite sure what's going on. If you had a 2-to-1, you'd have no trouble picking it out when you calibrate with a 1.2. But if you had, if you measure a 1.2 with a known calibration of 1.2, then you're in quite a bit of doubt. And I could go into a little bit more about why that exists, but as I said, it's not a showstopper. You just won't get quite as much accuracy down into the really the good termination regions if you don't have a good enough set of calibration devices. Back to you, Gary. KB2JXM, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. Possibly Gary got out of range, and hopefully he heard some of what I had to say. Network analyzers are very handy devices. In the very beginning, when they were being created in the time frame of around 1970 or so, people in a laboratory making measurements would start off with a signal generator, a spectrum analyzer, or a power meter, or some other way of detecting. And so you would put your device that you want to test on the bench, you plug in a signal generator at one end and adjust the frequency and the power output, you would put your detecting device on the other end, and you'd make a whole lot of individual measurements, you'd draw up a whole bunch of dots on an XY plot, you'd eventually connect them all with a straight line. All of a sudden, somebody said, gee, why don't we combine those instruments into one box, the signal generator and the detecting device, put them all into one box, and make the signal generator a frequency sweeping signal generator. Well, that was the birth of the network analyzer. You make that detecting device where it not only detects the power that comes out of your device on the test, your thing that you're testing, but it also measures its amplitude and phase angle. Now you're capable of taking the data you get out, displaying it on a polar diagram. A properly calibrated polar diagram called a Smith chart. So a Monday network analyzer gives you a Smith chart display and a sweeping line across that screen, which shows you exactly what the impedance is at every one of your test frequencies. The real and the imaginary portion, the in-phase and the quadrature phase, call it the amplitude and phase angle. There's all kinds of ways you can call it. But it gives you a beautiful plot on a Smith chart where you know exactly what your device looks like and either its gain or its input and output impedance characteristics are concerned. And if you want to make an improvement of the device that you're testing, the Smith chart tells you which way to go. Most of us who live in the States love the impedance of 50 ohms. Most of our instrumentation and most of our cables are 50 ohms. Whereas to the European, many of the European countries, 70 ohms is the magic number for their cables and their instrumentation. And each has its advantages and disadvantages. So a network analyzer, whether you set it up for 50 or 70 ohms, isn't too difficult. And a lot of data flows out of there in a hurry. If you're tuning a filter, for instance,
repeater, timeout,
and you're doing it on a network analyzer, you would be amazed how fast the process goes. And I could go into a little bit more description on that. I'll turn it over to Gary one more time to see if he's within range. KB2JXM, K2RIW. Looks like we caught him just as he was driving away. Barry, let's see if you're back upstairs and give us a few more words on those dishes that you've been looking at with a gleam in your eye for the last few months. And sounds like it was part of some kind of a ground station, or maybe it was a master antenna TV system for a particular apartment building. What do you think it was doing? I presume they're behind a fence right now, and their original use has been abandoned, and eventually they're going to be turned into scrap, is what it sounds like. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW.
K2J.
Eric recognized. Barry first, go ahead.
Okay, real good. Yeah, actually they are... how can I put this? They're not actually fenced in. They're on what appears to be private property. There's a fence around it except for one direction, which is the boardwalk. There's no fence there. I believe they were used originally for a C-band for TV a long time ago, because I don't think anybody's using C-band anymore for television reception, but that's my best guess as to what they were doing with it. But they sure had a lot of them. I mean, there's six or seven of them sitting in that lot, maybe more. I don't know why they needed so many all in one spot, but they did.
Okay. Sounds like it may have been part of a broadcast function of some kind. Maybe Eric knows. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RWK2J. What I suspect he said it was, Andrew, I'm looking at the specs of it. It's either a 3.6 or a 3.7 meter dish. Now, by the way, they're not 300-400 pounds. They're 700-800 pounds. They're just the pedestals, the pedals alone. The pedestal or the mounting bracket, that's a whole other thing. And by the way, C-band is very active. It's actually more active now since the direct-to-home satellites, you know, like DISH and DirecTV. But you got to understand that when you're looking at, one particular satellite, there's many satellites. You're going to cover the gamut of cable reception. You'll be looking at Galaxy 12, Galaxy 13. You'll be looking at what used to be known as GE, the GE satellites. What do they call them now? SES 1s and SES series of satellites. You actually need, if you want to get the 100 channels or so to distribute, you probably need a minimum of 3 or 4 dishes. But they also make dishes that cover a wide segment of the arc, so you can actually have 4, 5, 6 satellites all on the same dish. That would be the reason for it all being there.
The actual amount, if it's a 3.6 meter dish, that's a pretty hefty chunk of metal, and if you actually go to the website, and you can see all the installation instructions and how you're supposed to mount that in cement, etc., so on and so forth. Back to you, Dick. K2IW, KE2Tech.
Now, the one thing that confused me a little bit, Eric, is that you said C-band is still in great use, particularly for DirecTV. Now, I'm having a little problem with that one because the person, the average domestic DirecTV at-home reception is an 18-inch KU-band dish. So how is DirecTV using C-band, and is that only for commercial services like a broadcast ground station as opposed to a home installation? Give me a few more words on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, Eric, I got another question for you, too. How are they broadcasting it these days? What method are they using to broadcast it? Some kind of encryption or what? What are they doing these days?
All right, straighten you out, Dick. Because there is DirecTV and because there is DishTV, there's very little butts or, the, you know, big ugly dishes. Backyard dishes, the worry that the various different service providers had in terms of putting a lot of money and a lot of effort into encrypting the stuff on C-band was a big deal for them. So a lot of people were up on KU, which was even harder for some of the bud dishes in the old days because the size of the holes and the mesh that they would use for a reflector and a lot of the older ones were too big for KU. So, you know, with the coming of DirecTV and the direct-to-home services, or DTH as they call them, that has alleviated a lot of the operators' fears. And, you know, C-band is actually more crowded than it's ever been before. And if, let's say, those dishes were set up for 4 degrees, which would make them prior to, 1990, when they went to 2 degrees, those dishes were not really very effective because you would actually wind up seeing more than one satellite at a time. That could be a big problem. As far as what's on C-band, there is still some analog, not too much. Same thing on KU, there's still some analog. A lot of remote trucks will use analog, because they're too cheap to go digital, but actually it costs you less to use a part of a transponder than a whole transponder, so slowly everybody's switching over to digital. There isn't much, I mean, there is encryption, but with all the DVB stuff going on, they don't put a lot of effort into encrypting, unless, of course, you're HBO and you're carrying a backhaul signal and you don't want anybody to see it, then you actually bring in another encryption device, and either a Tandberg or various other companies, and hook that up to the video feed, and then you have some encryption. But for the most part, most of what's out there in C-band is a mix of video cipher 2, which is still in use, or DigiCypher actually, which is a digital version of it, which is being phased out pretty much by everybody. It's been phased out by PBS and
repeater. Time out.
You did time out for the last 30 seconds, Eric, but you're leading me to believe that quite a bit of C-band service still exists, both digital and old-fashioned analog, and some of it encrypted. The one thing I don't know is what services are the C-bands serving. I would guess an electronic news gathering truck would use KU-band with something like a 1.8 meter dish or whatever. Where is C-band really being used? Eric, go ahead.
No, I'm actually going to go right to the page which tells you what the services are. I give you a typical United States type of deal. So we've got the Atlantic. We don't want the Intelsats. We want stuff sitting over the United States. So here we go. C-band, you've got AMC-3, which is a typical cable satellite. This is AMC-3. It's at 87 degrees. The typical services on it are C-band, okay, APTN, which is AP, television news. You've got Fox Sports North, Fox Sports North, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Fox Alternate. On another transponder, you've got Comcast Sports Network and a whole bunch. And then another transponder is this TV network. That's DVB. Some foreign stuff, DNS, which is DVB. Okay, on another transponder, it's all on the same satellite. You decide for two. They've got WTVJ TV, WFOR TV, WPLG TV, WSEE TV in the Caribbean. On another transponder, we've got occasional feeds, which are NTSC, which are analog. Next transponder down, a whole lot of radio services. Then you've got Roberts, which is, most people know Roberts is RCN. They're based up in Canada. They're a drop.
I've got a quick question here, though, Eric, let me, and that is, I believe all those services are there, but what would make, and I presume the primary purpose for those services is act as the front end for a cable TV system, and that's where the data is actually coming from. Are they using C-band because of tradition, and they haven't yet switched over to KU? What would stop a service from not using those, getting those raw pieces of material from a KU band ground station instead of a C band? It began to sound like legacy and just carryover from the old C band days. Back to you, Eric.
It's all about cost, Dick. It's all about cost. So many of the C band satellites are piggyback with KU satellites. Like the huge 401 satellite is both a C band and KU band satellite. Power system to handle both. And it's about availability and cost, and with all the satellites that are up there, well, let me give you a count. Let's see, we've got, it's over the United States. We've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, let's say 35 satellites sitting over the U.S., and I'll pick any one of them, and they're fully loaded. You know, there are transponders that are kept for occasional use, for part-time use, for short-term leasing. A lot of the services have long-term, you know, they actually own the transponder, they buy the transponder. Let's see, here's a typical one, AMC 10, it's 135 degrees. On C-band, the MTV Networks owns 1, 2, 3 transponders, of which they have MTV Networks, Country Music Television, MTV East, Nickelodeon West, VH1 West, etc., you know, they're all Viacom services. But the reality is these satellites are jam-packed, and there ain't enough room for everybody.
Wow. And when you count to those 35 satellites, I think you're combining the count of the C-band services and the satellites that are KU-band services, and I know that many of the new birds are combined. I do remember at one time counting C-band satellites, and I found about 23 of them that were within view of my QTH. About 23 C bands and about 21 KU bands at one time. So I think you're counting both. Okay, a lot of stuff there. Huh. So a person who's really satellite oriented and wants to do, let's see now, what would you call it now? The modern day equivalent of microwave scanning. And he's got an 18 foot dish that's steerable, at least to follow the clock belt. He would find an awful lot of stuff to operate on. A brand new ground installation. It is my guess, Eric, that for the right number of dB of carry to noise ratio, a smaller dish could be used on KU band than on C band. But if I was setting up the dish and worrying about the cost of the dish, KU band would sound like a slightly cheaper operation on the assumption the bird is available with the data that I care about. Whereas KU band, C-band requires a slightly bigger dish. But footprint-wise, you know something about the DBEIRP of each of these satellites and where their footprint is. My guess is a high percentage of those satellites would give you a minimum of 9 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio on C-band with a 18-foot dish. I wonder if you'll confirm some of that. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Alright, K2RIW, K2EJ. The cost that I'm talking about, actually, are not the ground station cost, but the actual cost of transponder time. All the big guys like the cable networks and stuff like that, they lease the entire transponders, like PBS. Now, we originally started out using, six full 50 megahertz wide transponders, no, 35 megahertz wide transponders. Now we're down to two because we fit everything in digitally to reduction of bit rate. We actually take a transponder with 35 megahertz slot and divvy it up. When we start talking HD, then we actually only get maybe three HD signals on one transponder, but we can have six or eight or ten standard definition signals on a single transponder. Don't forget that the C-bands are still only 15 or 20 watts in terms of output, so that requires the big dish to get your signal noise good. And in addition, most of today's satellites are capable of creating spot beams, thereby illuminating an area geographically located in one locale for one set of services on the same frequency, another spot beam pointing at a different part of the United States, servicing another locale with services. So it also is used to prevent people from picking stuff up outside the area of coverage. And that also includes the DirecTV satellites. They have a spot beam capability too. K2IW, K2J.
Okay, the watts of output from those satellites strikes me by old-fashioned standards fairly high. In the old days, 5 watt output from a satellite on C-band going into a 10-foot diameter ground station with a good low-noise amplifier would give you a healthy 9 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio and therefore essentially a nearly snow-free picture. Not very many sparklies in there. 5 watts, satellite, geosynchronous orbit into a 10-foot dish used to do that. Aren't those kind of numbers also true today? Does the digital broadcasting, high def and whatever, require a greater number of decibels of carrier-to-noise ratio? Run a few of those numbers by with me, Mel. Here we go. Eric, K2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Let me get to the actual specifications of a typical satellite, which I'm doing now. Let's see. Let's take an SES satellite, which is, like the one that we use, which is AMC-21. Let me get to the right page here, and I will give you exactly what you want to know. Actually, the thing that you need to change to do digital is, AMC-15, AMC-21, that's solid. That's a KU only, so let's see what the specifications on it are. You actually need LNBs that are better in terms of phase noise. The satellite data, there we go. This is a KU band, okay, and this is a new one. This is a big one. It's 110 watts, which is a biggie. The beacon's at 11.7 gigs and 12.1 gigs. So that may be a bad guy to look at. Let's look at a C-band. But let me also see what the saturation is. It covers maps. It's multiple beams. They run anywhere between where you are between 46 and 50, so that's a heck of a lot of signal. Let me let it drop. Let's look at a KU C-band.
By 46 to 50, I think you're talking about dBW of EIRP, decibels with reference to 1 watt. I do remember some of the old birds were numbers like 36 and 37, and I think that's ABW effective isotropic radiated power. Is that true? And by the way, I, in the old days, a plus 36, plus 37, I think a 10-foot dish would give you reasonably good reception on those in those days. That would suggest that a C-band dish today could be considerably smaller. Back to you, Eric.
Right, yeah, no, that's correct. Let me get to the right page here. C-band. That's KU, that's the same kind of number. C-band is 37 to 41, let's say. And the actual satellite data says... It doesn't say. Come on. Well, let me pick a different one. You actually can have a lower signal strength with the digital stuff. It's, you can get good pictures when, if you were looking at an analog thing, the sparklies would be so bad you could barely see it. You do a digital signal on something like that, and you're as good as gold. Here we go. This is, again, from 36 to 41 coverage. How much power is that? Here we go. This is a C-band. It's got 24 and 36 megahertz transponders. It's TWT, and this is a new one. It's 30 watts and 60 watts.
Yeah, those are some nice powers. Sounds to me like a person might get away with a 5 or 6 foot dish nowadays on C-band. And I presume the reason you need a higher spectral purity of the local oscillator that's in your low noise block down converter is that with digital TV, I'm guessing that that pilot signal has to be experienced, has to be received with a rather good spectral purity signal to noise ratio, because the locking or the synchronization on the pilot tone is what allows all the rest of the digital demodulation to take place. That's my guess, and correct me on that one, Eric, go ahead.
Oh, that's a good thought, but don't go through that much trouble. The reason why you have to have low phase noise is to minimize the jitter. Most satellite digital transmissions are QPSK, 4PSK, and 8PSK. There is no pilot tone, there's no special signal.
So I think you're saying the digital technique that's used for high def over the air, ATSC type television, is not the same. That's the same encoding technique that's used for the vent pipe of a satellite. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
That's correct. The type of encoding that's actually used is similar to PSK-31. It's close to that. If you're really going to do 8PSK, then you have a symbol that has, I think after you do the error correction, you round up with 4 bits per symbol.
Very nice. Let's see if Barry, who got us all off on this subject, Barry in 2MB, any further questions or comments on all of the above? And it looks like those satellite, those fiberglass dishes are super heavy. That's, I was guessing, and it looks like we guessed a little bit low. They're really heavier than we thought, Barry. N2 Moon Bounce, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised I was able to move them at all. Mention it. All right. Yeah, Eric, I got one more question for you. Is anybody making a C or KU band receiving system anymore? In other words, that you can hook up to your TV set, preferably one of the high-definition TV sets. Anybody doing that anymore, or is that something that you can't get anymore?
All right, there's two ways you can go with that. There's something called free-to-air receivers. They're made by companies like Pansat, Verisat, ThisSat, ThatSat. They're usually made in Korea. And they're actually designed to steal DirecTV. Not DirecTV, EchoStar, Dish TV. Although they just changed their encryption system, so there's hundreds of thousands of these receivers all over the place. That the people are waiting for the guys to crack the new encryption. They went to Nagravision 3. They were on Nagravision 2, which was easy to crack. But all these receivers know about these current satellites that are up there, and you can buy them from anywhere from like $100 to $300. And that's the cheap way to go. If you want to buy a DVB receiver, you can get them from Standard. If you remember, they used to make radios. They still do, actually. It's actually Vertex standard. You can buy them from Motorola. You can buy them from Scientific Atlanta, but you're going to be starting prices around $1,000 and up.
I can't imagine myself wanting to do that. Okay. Thanks, Eric. That's really good news. So it sounds like these, I don't know, there used to be a few guys on the Internet, and they would send out catalogs that were selling that stuff. I can't even remember their names anymore because it's been too long. Are those guys still in business?
No, I was just thinking of another guy who used to live in Plainview that used to do, you know, home satellite dishes way back when. He's actually down in Florida. Now, do a Google search for FTA, free to air, and you'll find it. And if you want to see what actual satellites are up there and what they've got on them, there's a site you can go to called Wingsat, www.lyngsat.com. And it has the latest and greatest current information of what's on what transponder on what satellite.
I'm trying to write that down. L-Y-N-G-S-A-T. This brings back memories because I actually do remember looking at that site. Oh, gosh, it must have been 3-4 years ago already. So I guess these guys are still around. Excellent, excellent. I think I've figured out what my new winter hobby is going to be.
Eric, that mail order catalog that used to come from Thief River Falls, Minnesota, as I remember. But I can't think of the name of the darn company. And they...
Sun Company.
Say that again, because I covered you up. Go ahead.
Dawn Company, D-A-W-N.
Okay, there's another one. There's another one that's got the word SAT or Sky, Sky Vision. Isn't that the Sky View, Sky Vision, something like that? There's another one, mail order catalog, selling you all kinds of satellite-type equipment. Do they still exist?
Yes, believe it or not, there's still a whole bunch of them. They focus more on little dish stuff, but they still sell big dish stuff.
How about that? So there are a small number of, hardcore individuals out there that had a C-band system because they live in the tule weed somewhere, and they're maintaining those systems and still buying the hardware. Is that approximately what's going on?
You can, but the problem is now the folks who do DigiCypher and that sort of thing, they're still an organization that will collect your money and provide you with services on various different transponders. But the number of services they can provide, I think, is getting smaller and smaller.
Now, for the real serious satellite watcher, if you've got a big enough dish and a horizon-to-horizon actuator, you used to be able to look at the Intelsats that were over the Atlantic, and you could watch an awful lot of European television. To your knowledge, is that still possible? Go ahead.
Yeah, I do that all the time at work. I actually have one dish that's permanently affixed at PAS-9, P-A-S-9, which is an Intelsat. I think it's at, I don't remember what it is. Hang on, let me see if I can find it. I'll tell you where it sits in this cup.
Do you hear me now?
Not there, here it is. Let me go to this page. Sorry about that. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of them. I'll tell you what they are in a second.
Is that particular satellite to the east, like 20 or 30 degrees above your eastern horizon to pick up an Intelsat?
Give me a second and I'll tell you where it is. That's 61 degrees. That's too close. One more second, Dick.
Yeah, I think I used to be able to... I'm 73 degrees west of Greenwich, and I think I used to be able to watch satellites that were out at a 125, 135 degrees. So I guess I could go roughly 50 degrees to the west. If I go 50 degrees to the east, I'd be able to pick up a satellite that's at a longitude of around Greenwich minus 20. Is that true? Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't remember where the horizon is, but I know I pick up, 58 degrees west is past 9, and I know I can just about make 50 degrees. After that, I think it all goes away.
Oh, so you're only able to get 40 degrees from zenith. Is that because of local blockage? If that dish was higher up off the ground, would you be able to get closer to the horizon and see that bird? or is it because the bird's footprint doesn't favor you? Go ahead.
No, it's because I have this bloody hill and development next to me. It looks like I'm pointing a dish into the ground almost. But, yeah, actually, the one that's looking at past nine is about 20, 30 feet higher, so it looks just over the top of all that garbage. And, you know, that's the big one's an 8-meter dish, so, you know, it's kind of clunky. But, yeah, but the best that I've been able to do on that, I think, was just, there's one more satellite at 45 degrees west. That's it. I think I just about get that, and that's all I can see, because then I'm looking into dirt anyway.
Yeah, funny story along those lines is that, I guess 10 or so, 15 years ago, I was at about the 80-foot level of a tree just off to the edge of my property to the west, and I'm trimming branches off that tree so that I'd be able to take my television receive-only terminal that's mounted at the 75-foot level, was at the 60-foot level of the tower, and I wanted to be able to go down close enough to the horizon, look through that tree without seeing the branches, so that I could see the Learn Alaska program that was on one of the satellites that's very far to the west. I just wanted to see what Alaska programming looked like. And a buddy of mine who lived up at Farmingville on top of the hill was able to get that satellite, and I wasn't, and that bugged me. Well, I wasn't able to trim enough of the branches to clear. The nice thing about a real good low-noise block down converter these days, I guess on C-band they get down to like 15 degrees Kelvin, is that they got good sensitivity. However, if you look through one branch of one tree, which radio-wise is a blazing white hot object at 300 degrees Kelvin, it makes a darn much noise, that the signal is there, but the signal-to-noise ratio is yucky, and the satellite receiver says, forget it. So the one thing about ground stations of my size is that they got to look through clear blue sky, no trees. You've got that 8-meter dish or whatever it is that you're using. I guess you can tolerate quite a bit of local trees and whatever and still get enough signal-to-noise ratio. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. I'll just remember this. With the digital world, if you can barely get a picture in analog, you'll get a perfectly locked picture on digital. The Alaska stuff is on AMC-8. I've seen that. I can see that. It's 139 degrees west. So, you know, that dish is looking at your western horizon when you're looking for that. And it's all digital services. If you were looking at it digitally today, you'd have absolutely no problem with picking everything up. Don't forget that NASA TV, the western one, is on AMC-7, which is at 137 degrees. And, of course, you need a DVB receiver for that because they don't transmit analog anymore. The one that we actually look at for PBS is not that far away. It's at 125 degrees. So, and if you come by the place, you'll see that my dish is looking right smack through the middle of the tower, and the tower doesn't bother it at all. So, I'll give you a little concept of it.
Exactly. As long as you're looking through a non-radiative device, simple pieces of metal are radio-wise ice cold, whereas leaves and absorptive devices, they have the ability to absorb signal, and they're warm, not cryogenically cooled, they have the ability to emit signal. Reciprocity, if you know what I mean. I better pick up Lou because we've been keeping him waiting quite a long, and then I'm going to come back to all this subject if Barry's still around. It's a fun subject. Lou, W2JPW. What's going on over there in Allendale, New Jersey? What's keeping you busy these days? As I look at you, QS.com, I realize you are 8 years older than me. Wow. So, slightly more senior, Louis, go right ahead, W2JPW, K2RIW.
Okay, good. K2RIW on the net, W2JPW. Yep, I'm an old guy now. I keep busy, but I haven't done too much with radio lately, which is making me very sad. But I have a question for you that doesn't have anything to do with anything personal, but the national scene. In a week from now, my congressional representative is coming to town, and he's going to have a meeting here, and we're going to talk to him about things like health care and so forth, give him what we think about that. But what I want to talk about with him is cuts in ballistic missile early warning system. So I've been studying up on that. But I wanted to ask you, I know you know a lot about this, We have this system that's used by the U.S. around the world. It's called PAVE, pause, position, acquisition, vehicle, entry, pause, phased array, warning system. It's a huge fixed radar installation, and it works on 70 centimeters and thereabouts. And even before they had the phased array, which came in around the 1970s, they used steerable, mechanically steerable antennas like we hams do, except much bigger, of course, you know, big 70-foot dish or whatever. I wonder why they like that frequency for ballistic missile early warning. I've always wondered this, but now that I'm thinking about it, I'm going to be talking to these people, try to get them to change their minds about these cuts. I'm very curious as to, I can think of only one reason that maybe the path loss is better, but other things are so much worse, like Faraday rotation and even slight changes in refractive index of the ionosphere and lower ionosphere at 440 megahertz compared with above 1 gigahertz. So I'm very curious as to why they like that frequency for all of this kind of work. Dick, so back to you. Go ahead.
W2VL repeater.
Very nice stuff, Lou. Oh boy, you're into quite a subject now. I don't know if PAVE pause specifically is used for it, but a number of the radars in that approximate frequency region had a lot of capability when it comes to over-the-horizon OTH-type radars. And with over-the-horizon-type radars and something that's called radio science techniques, they're able to track moving objects, figure out what they are, what direction they're traveling, how fast they're traveling, how many of them, over the horizon. You wouldn't be, you and I have heard things like holography. In other words, with a fancy three-dimensional type negative, you can make a picture that to the human eye looks like it's got a three-dimensional characteristic to it when it's played back. Well, over the horizon radar can do holography-like things. And so when you're at frequencies like 70 megacycles, many of the kinds of targets you care about, aircraft, ground vehicles, ships, and whatever, have very nice RCS, radar cross-section. Many devices, as you go higher and higher in frequency, particularly if they are rounded objects, the radar cross-section tends to decrease. In other words, the amount of echo power when you go up in frequency for typical types of vehicles, the echo power decreases. That combined with extra space loss, both going out and coming back, starts hurting you. If, for instance, on a slightly similar object, if you studied a radio frequency identification tag system, you'd realize that 70 megacycles would give you the biggest bang for the dollar. At lower frequencies, you can't develop enough antenna gain. At higher frequencies, you get too much space loss and too little area of the actual simple dipole that's the tag antenna itself. So if the United States would allow it, the 70 centimeter or 430 megacycle region would give you ideal RFID tags. The license free band, let me drop, that we've got in the United States at 902 to 928 megacycles is almost as good. And various people have proposed using smaller tags on bottle caps for pharmaceuticals and whatever, and operating them at the next license free band up at 2.3 gigahertz. And you study an RFID tag at 2.3 gigs versus one at 900 megs, and there's a huge difference in the range at which you can read that tag. So 70 centimeters, 430 type megacycles, got a lot of advantages. That PAVE pause radar is a huge phased array, a pyramid-shaped thing on the ground, which can steer that beam. And it's got ridiculous amounts of agility. It can transmit a whole lot of power. It can swish the frequency. It can phase shift the frequency. It can chirp the frequency. It can change the pulse width, the pulse rep rate. When I used to listen to the PAVE pause radar that was at Otis Air Force Base at Cape Cod with my 432 equipment, it sounded like a bunch of clicks and pops. It didn't sound like a radar at all. You think somebody is randomly flipping a light switch on and off somewhere in the house. It gave you those kind of sounds. And so
for the hams who lived on Cape Cod within a certain number of miles of that radar, you had to limit your power output so as